I mean, you know how these things work. Ophir was supposed to be here. Ophir is great, terrific. That's great technical work. Ophir is Israeli. I understand Ophir and his company are in the process of becoming no longer one, and their willingness to support an expensive trip to Vegas was limited by that. So Ophir is cleaning up his act in Israel, and I'm sure he'll be with a new company and will be back soon. You know how it works. I've gotten to know Ophir. Where have I seen him? San Diego. I'll see him in Australia. I'll see him in Israel. Amsterdam. You know, we never see each other where we live because the headspace that we live in is this network out here, and it's kind of what I think was referred to in the keynote as a deperimeterization of our lives. But the keynote did not go nearly far enough. One of the joys of being asked to plug in is you get to say whatever you want, and so I will use a template from a speech that, like, you know, you always carry your thumb drive and you have speeches on it. Have mouth, will travel. And this particular one is I gave at this security forum at the Pentagon last Tuesday in Washington. And just to show you how porous boundaries are and amorphous our identities can be, it was clear that at least one-third of the people in the conference center in the Pentagon were people I knew from DEF CON. And one came up, short blonde hair, 1 inch tall. Don't you remember me from DEF CON? And I flashed suddenly on the shoulder length hair, you know, the spikes, the piercings, the whole thing from last year. And he said, your hobby is always your hobby. It just changes. The paycheck is what changes. So this is part of what we're up against. What I want to talk about is the assumptions we make, really. This will apply to other areas of your life because one thing is everything. One thing represents everything. But we're talking about the security space per se. Are you coming to fix the mic or is everything cool? Oh, okay. I'm not using PowerPoint or slides. Why? There was recently in NASA's Columbia accident investigation board, and what it determined was one of the contributing factors, a significant contributing factor to the explosion of the space shuttle, or its breakup upon reentry, was the use of PowerPoint. Now, and that's no joke, although PowerPoint is. And this is how it evolves. I'm going to use this as a template. And it's how I want you to look at the truth of the security space. Because the truth always arrives at the edge unheard and then moves toward the center in our day and age more and more rapidly, where it forms the core of a new consensus reality. By the time the truth has moved to the center and formed the core of a new consensus, and everyone knows that it is true, it is a lie. It is no longer true. But it was true when it first emerged, and it is mostly true as it moves. And PowerPoint is a good example. When it first came on, I perceived what PowerPoint did, I think, correctly. Everyone I knew who gave speeches began to use PowerPoint. It just became ubiquitous. And when I went to a place like GE Medical, I spent 3 days with them talking about creation and innovation. And they said, we want you to do the keynote and then help this, the head of IT with the close. What kind of PowerPoint, what kind of slides are you going to use? I said, none. They said, this is GE. They will not be able to understand your presentation if it is not amplified, magnified, and reduced and filtered through PowerPoint. One of the things the NASA report said was that some of the slides used at NASA had such a density of information on them that it was impossible to read them. Have you ever seen a slide that was impossible to read? All the time. It's one of the weakest links. It's too small, it's too packed, or as always happens, it is too general and oversimplified. It forces people to think in an oversimplified manner, a bullet way of thinking. What can be reduced to 10 words? It's like I'm told in the speaking business by those who think they know how to do it, that I should never use a word that has more than 3 syllables. Because no one will ever understand it. The result, of course, is audiences that never hear words more than 3 syllables and therefore never do understand the words. Just like children talk to in baby talk all their lives will never progress past baba and dada. The way you learn a language is by being called upward through the linguistic space it defines by defining something bigger than you are. And it's the same in the security space. Matt Blaze said at Computers, Freedom, and Privacy, when in Austin a few years ago, that the weakest link in any security chain is often the definition of the problem. The definition of the problem is the weakest link, and yet it is that which we do not see when we look at the problem. Robin Williams, Robin Roberts, who was head of R&D, InfoSec R&D at CIA for a while now with Cisco, she said, the problem is you're dealing with systems that have all sorts of assumptions built in, but you cannot query the system about its assumptions. It does not know what they are. And therefore, if you do not drill deeply down into the structure of the system you have built, you will not know what assumptions it is making, above all, about human nature. Someone from the Pentagon leaned over during Robert Morris's wonderful and brilliant speech, especially because he flogged my book, which is worth more than the book that he stole from me. He absolutely did that. Aside, the way he did it, I mean, this is elegant. These are the learnings you have at a conference like this that you don't anticipate. I showed him the book, right, a little self-aggrandizement. This is my book. He looked at it, and while we kept talking, he opened his bag, and he put it in. So pretty soon, the book had disappeared. And I waited for him to reach for his wallet, open his wallet, and take something out, but that didn't happen. And so, sleight of hand. So we began talking about what he had done. I said, my God, this man has balls. This man has stolen my book and he's not even acknowledging it while we're talking about it. And he continued the conversation as if to verify and validate that. And the wonderful thing was then he did reach in the bag and say, as long as I have your book, would you mind signing it for me? But obviously, reciprocity is so deeply built into the Neolithic soul. You do something for me, I have to do something for you. Why they send us junk in the mail, feeling of obligation to send cash back. He obviously felt a sense of reciprocity. We became close friends in 48 hours, and he held up the book. Now, I was talking about something, I don't remember what. Pentagon person leaned over during the talk. Yeah, he did. All right. Would you come up and do the next paragraph, please? Well, what I was talking about was the definition of the system in the program. It'll come back. About 20 minutes from now, I will say, oh, I remember. And then we'll go there again. But the thing about the PowerPoint was that PowerPoint does force you to oversimplify your thinking, and it does something else. It engages with the part of the brain that is not the part of the brain that I want you to engage with now as we have a conversation. What this really is about is becoming conscious of the conversation, the discourse that determines the questions that you ask, and therefore, inevitably, the answers. The discourse, the conversation. It's determined by the leadership of any organizational structure, but more deeply than that, it's determined by the culture itself. You go into any culture and you know that you discover four kinds of rules, right? There are those that are known and written, those that are known and unwritten, those that are unknown and written, and those that are unknown and unwritten. So you can look at what those are. The rules that are known and written are the ones they give you, and everybody reads the manual and it's filed. And they've been written down, and you all know what they are. The ones that are written and unknown are about the 80% of the rules in the manual that is given to you that you read and forget or never read in the first place. So they're written, but they're unknown. But that isn't what determines the behaviors in a culture. What determines the behaviors in a culture are the rules that are known but unwritten. This is the tribal knowledge that is disseminated throughout the culture by the conversation and above all by the thought leaders who are having the conversation. So when Matt Blaze says that the weakest link is often the definition of the problem, it is often the unexamined assumptions about what it is we are doing. It's about trying to query the system, as Robin said, and not being able to get an answer back, or as someone else, Saul Svee, this is where I was going. You see how an old man does it? The mouth continues to engage, sooner or later it will suck in the ideas that it was attempting to access. And so, Saul Svee was the, had a role in Microsoft Israel's security team. She's recently moved to Redmond. And she'd gotten to know me through the Black Hat tapes, which are online. And it's wonderful, you know, to live in this world where we can access each other literally like this. And she wrote a wonderful paper on the black appliance box that people are increasingly inserting into their security systems. Increasingly, she said, people are putting appliances into their systems, which they have not dissected and analyzed. Therefore, they do not know what it is that exactly that it does. And you go to some conferences where people, sell, the vendors or the pushers from the platform are selling an appliance without giving you the granular details. It hasn't even often been analyzed at the granular level you need to know. And therefore, Saul said, the feeling of security is inversely in proportion to what people know about their systems. Now think about that. The more you know about the system and what is in it, the less secure you feel. Because the more you know how porous it is and how the many applications interact with one another in undetermined and unforeseeable ways to create exploit opportunities for people. Now, the exploit opportunities, this is why it gets very murky. In security, one of the unexamined assumptions is often that we are trying to fix holes. But there's an entire industry, there's an entire world that militates against fixing the holes in systems. And it depends on the motivation of the people, and that's why you have to look a little more deeply at what people really have an investment in. You all know the jokes about, except they're not always jokes. I know a guy who was in college, he was a system administrator, and he didn't have any money, so he got put a virus on the system, they called him, come in, he spent the weekend fixing the virus and got overtime. I mean, it's not unusual for people who are paid to fix things that are broken to break things so that they can fix them. So there is an industry based on that. What did we do when the Cold War ended? We invented the war on drugs. What did we do when the war on drugs was a dud? A, drugs are not going away. Too many people make money from it. Too many people profit from it. So now we have the war on terror. I refer you to a book called The Closed World by Paul N. Edwards, who was at Stanford, I believe, then. Now he's at the University of Michigan, which describes the evolution of the closed world, which is the simulated model of reality which we made choices since World War II ongoingly to have and to build, into which people then began to live as if it was real. And once you begin to believe the model of reality which the computer gives you, the whole computer network, you cease to have an access to the reality which enables you to stand outside it and examine the system and its assumptions in order to see what it is you truly believe. Because those things that are known but unwritten by everybody so deeply that they no longer are known to be known, then those determine the parameters of the conversation, and the conversation inflects the culture. And it's not always what you think. Sometimes people come up and share things after these talks, which is where I really learn at these conferences. And one fellow, we were talking about the management of perception and how difficult it is to know what's really real. Talked about his experience doing CI, counterintelligence for the Army, and he was gung-ho, as young people will be for a few months, until the rocks of reality dashed those hopes. And so he was being sent to Haiti, and it was at a crisis in Haiti's, a time of crisis in Haiti, and one of his missions was to do counterintelligence and to understand the network of the narco-terrorists and the narcotics cartels that were using Haiti as an access point, flow-through for huge amounts of money, money laundering, and narcotics distribution. When he got there, there was a coup. I don't remember if the Prime Minister was killed or just dismissed and sent to another home somewhere else, but wherever he went, it was a change of regime, like we're going to have in November, perhaps. You just never know. And he was excited because of the opportunity it gave him to really attack narcotics and all the evil that they did. But what he noticed at that time, it was under Clinton, was that the first person on the scene from Washington was one of Clinton's Arkansas cronies. And one of his jobs was to make sure that the routes remained intact. In other words, what he discovered was that the people who he thought, on whose behalf he was doing this work, in fact profited from and wanted to keep secure the system that he thought it was his task in counterintelligence to help to dismantle. And then it poses interesting questions for you in security. One fellow came up with a similar kind of conundrum where ethics gets very gray and murky. And he worked for an exchange in New York, and not the New York Stock Exchange, but there are many exchanges, and he worked for one. And his job was to secure the perimeter, as the man said, to secure the system from unwarranted intrusion. Because there were intrusions all the time, they seemed to be coming from people who were after information, not to do anything destructive. And he kept noticing them, and he had the logs, and he went to the people to whom he had to report. He wasn't the top of the chain. And he said, I can fix this system so that we can respond in real time to a lot of these intrusions and shut them out and shut them down, and they won't take place. And the word that really came back to him, whether subtext or text, it's never going to be in a telegram, it's never going to be in a memo, was we can't do that. because the board of directors of the exchange are the people who are hacking into the system in order to get inside information about transactions before they're public. Okay, so you got the idea.
So here you are saying, we're just talking Robert Morris and others, we were talking a guy from InQtel, we're talking about identity as the fundamental issue that we confront. Is there a guy from InQtel? You know, CIA, I mean, they really asked some good questions, the 30%,
by which I mean CIA was described to me by someone inside as 60% bureaucrats, 30% intelligent and creative people, and 10% psychotics. And the way it works is the 60% who are bureaucrats keep that structure going. So the 30% who are an intelligent, creative bunch can create schemes beyond your imagining that the psychotics are more than willing to carry out. Right? So we were talking about the fundamental issues that really underlie what we're talking about, security. What the hell are you trying to secure? The deperimeterization didn't go nearly far enough because it was defined in terms of business. He said it's about money, and therefore you have to secure money. So there are two major, I think, faults in that thinking that show you how he's trying to get to assumptions, but there are many, many other assumptions below those assumptions. First of all, money. Money is not a thing. It's an exchange mechanism for that which has value. People are not always after just money or trying to secure money so that if you put a hard case or a shell around the money, then the money is intact. It's what's worth money. And what is worth money in our day and age more than ever is information, which has a value proportionate to the length of time it is known by the public or unknown to the public. And therefore, what you're trying to secure is information. But what information? Well, you think you have an aggregate, a picture, a big picture of what information is valuable based on the story that you have been told about what it is you're doing, the narrative that defines your enterprise. That goes back to the conversation, the discourse. But that is fundamentally impaired because bits of information, which when extracted willy-nilly here and there through all sorts of means of gathering data and information, and then put together to build that big picture, like traffic analysis, as Robert Morris was alluding to, then it enables someone to know the assumptions of the system that the system itself does not know. It's what intelligence is about. Getting bits and pieces, which intuitive, creative people then aggregate into a big picture that reveals more than people creating the information know it reveals in the first place. So what is it, in fact, you are trying to secure? Well, we're trying to secure a business. Well, what business is it? I was at a stock market conference not too long ago, well, several years ago. It's when people in the investment world, I was doing keynote for AIMR, which was then the Association for Investment Management and Research. And these were the managers of mutual funds and pension funds. A lot of money, billions of dollars. And they were trying to get their minds at that time around the notion of transglobals. Now, they thought they knew what transglobals were because these were companies that had a base in one or another country and operated in many countries. But in fact, that wasn't the emergent reality of a transglobal. A transglobal was truly a transcendent entity that might have originated in a country but sprang loose from its moorings like a dirigible on a thin line that finally popped and hovered indeed, like cyberspace seemed to hover once upon a time, over nation states. Now, where did nation states come from? Look at the 17th, 18th, 19th century above all. Nation states are abstractions, images, metaphors, ideas. It does not exist. You know that. You know there are no dots on the map that define a nation state. And if there were, you know that in the last 10 years we've had to rewrite the maps over and over and over again until appropriately it's only on computers that maps should exist because they have to be revised so frequently. Nation states are boundaries around a level of economic, social, and political organization that was appropriate to the flow, the speed of the flow, and the immensity of the flow of information at a particular time in the evolution of culture. In other words, prior to the emergence of nation states, we could have other kinds of boundaries around other kinds of entities, like principalities and duchies and small empires or large empires. But we didn't have nation states with boundaries around them that facilitated the economic, social, and political intercourse of peoples in the world which had come to define itself as a collection, aggregate, of nation states. In other words, identity is a boundary around an identity. But boundaries are exactly what's morphing and are also the means of defining security and privacy and intellectual property. Identity as an individual, identity in the aggregate. I'm going to be talking at DEF CON about the identity of individuals as evolving from the Renaissance and
why it doesn't always apply when you look at the individual as a node in a network and therefore not as a bounded entity. So what has happened to nation states? Well, the transglobal thing is very interesting. What they discovered was that transglobal companies like General Electric, for example, or Citicorp, had emerged, which literally did not belong to any country, and therefore, as you know, often had much more power than many countries. With little countries and big entities like the Russian Mafia and Sierra Leone, it's easy to see. Sierra Leone became a wholly owned subsidiary of the Russian Mafia. Now, the Russian Mafia wasn't fooling around. These are not Italians playing games, being on television, you know, whacking people here and there. Russian Mafia is serious. John Gotti's lieutenant said, listen, you cross us, we'll kill you, but these bastards will kill your whole family. I mean, when John Gotti's lieutenants speak with a quaking voice of the Russian Mafia, I don't want to cross these guys. And when they came out of the Gulag in the 80s, that great campaign, Let My People Go, so many of them did go to Israel where they could claim rights of citizenship only for the purpose of getting that citizenship. So Israel, a country of 5 million people, finds itself with 500,000, 10% of Russians, finds 10% of the 500,000, 50,000 are engaged one way or the other with the Russian Mafia. Does it affect things? Yes. Netanyahu is wholly owned. Is this being recorded? Some say, some allege, some believe that Netanyahu and other politicians are seriously affected by the inflow of money from those sources. And they, of course, function in stealthy ways. A friend I know who does security in Israel said he was putting together a program. You know, when you come to Israel as a Jew, you get a year or two, is it, of money to help you, $10,000 or whatever, and help you get on your feet. Well, obviously, it's a recipe for fraud, right? So a lot of people were creating false identities in order to collect all these monies flowing to the false identities. And he put together a beautiful, sophisticated computer program that would identify the fraudulent identities with some degree of success. And of course, he got the knock on the door and the visit, and Boris came in and said, we don't like that program. And if you send it out there where people start to use it, we'll kill you. So that was the end of that program. So that's the way it is. That's just the way it is. That's the bottom line. That's the assumption of the world in which we live, which we have to make, because who are the identities of these people we meet in the shadows, these nefarious people? There are often enough working for intelligence communities that are supposedly enemies. We're in bed with all sorts of people. Robert Morris said that over coffee the other day. If people knew, the man in the street, the woman in the street, knew the names and identities, the people with whom we are in bed, with whom we are supposedly, allegedly at war, or at least at odds, they would run screaming into the night because they would be so confused by how do we sort this world out. So the management of perception at the top level becomes critical. Illusions, misdirection, even ridicule. To manage the top level of perception, keep the society orderly while down at the greater depths, the assumptions about what it's really like are taking place. This profoundly affects security people because the question is, as I said, who is it you are securing? Who are you? Who do you work for? So as transglobals emerge that span countries and are greater than countries. A small story, I did this thing for GE and I heard this interesting story that during the time Pakistan and India were ramping up their nuclear threats to each other, saber-rattling, GE ran a war game. And the purpose of the war game was to determine what would be the cost to this transglobal nation of a nuclear exchange between India and Pakistan? A very reasonable cost of doing business question to ask. If there's nuclear war in this subcontinent, how will it damage the human capital in which we have invested so much and the physical capital in which we have invested so much? The result of that war game is predictable. We can't take that hit. A nuclear war would be too destructive. You would think you could come to that conclusion intuitively and quickly, but it required a whole war game for them to arrive at it. At which point the CEO of General Electric spoke to the Prime Minister of India and said, listen, you've got to ramp this down. We can't afford a nuclear war. Now, all that does is illuminate just a little more clearly than usual the fact that countries which evolved, as I said previously, as appropriate boundaries are now amorphously in relationship to transglobal non-state entities, whether they be corporations or narco-terrorists or cartels or terror groups or money launderers or whatever. Money laundering is just the obvious place to look to see how security can be done. A friend of mine, Rachel Ehrenfeld, ran the Center for something of Democracy in New York. You know, she's hopeless, naive, innocent, because she is still trying to bring people to account on behalf of the ideals which she continues to hold. So she was talking to somebody from the International Monetary Fund not long after 9/11, and she said, we don't have to make a big deal out of tracking money. We know how to track money. We know where the money goes. We know how it's laundered. We know who's doing it. What it will require is simply exposing the truth about it to the world. And the man from the IMF, who was a ranking official, said, listen, we do not have the political will to do that. We have to settle for something less. Because to do that would expose the entire global financial system for what it is. And in terms of economics, the money doesn't care where it comes from. It doesn't care what label you put on it. I mean, we're in Las Vegas, for heaven's sakes. I mean, where did Las Vegas come from? Well, there's 1947, Bugsy Siegel standing in the middle of the desert, nuts but visionary, said, what am I going to do? Was it the Sands? Is that the first one? Well, he got whacked because it didn't turn a profit fast enough, but his vision was real. And what was Las Vegas through the 50s and the 60s but a conduit for laundering vast amounts of money that then washed back into legitimate businesses and participated in the scale of corrupting democracy and judges and mayors and police at a level that had never before done. There's always corruption. But what Vegas stands for is the institutionalization and the really the adoration of this process. So much money came out here from Chicago where I grew up, and you couldn't grow up in Chicago without knowing what was going on. You had to know what was going on in order to live in Chicago. I got through Northwestern working for an alderman, and he was typical. If he had four ways of doing something, and three were legal and one was illegal, he always did it illegally, just to maintain his integrity. I mean, that's the way, it's just the way it was. You know, they asked me to be precinct captain when I was 18. I said, 18, you got to be 21. They said, don't worry. You didn't need the internet to get false documents. We'll get you 21. 21 is easy. I said, well, what's happening to Kitty, our Democratic precinct captain? They said, oh, nothing's happened to Kitty, but you asked me to be precinct captain. Oh, idiot, you know, because I didn't have the right assumptions. We want you to be the Republican precinct captain. That way you can sabotage campaigns, tell us what they're doing, you know, mess things up. Just take orders from us on behalf of destroying them. I was 18, and so I was just getting a lesson in how things work. Well, the advent of these trans-global entities and the fact that they often have much more power than nation states means there is a shift in power, and it is constantly shifting, and therefore those dilemmas of the people who found out they thought they were working for somebody and they found out they're not working for the person they thought they were working for, what I'm fundamentally trying to confront you with is that question, who do you work for? When you secure information, at what level of abstraction do you put a boundary around it? What is the source of the information you are securing that has value, that changes into money somewhere along the line? What is the origin of it? What is its destination? What is it ultimately going to be used for? Who are you in this task? And are you willing to become conscious of it? Marshall McLuhan said that so long, nothing is inevitable, so long as we are willing to become conscious of what is happening. The level of consciousness to which I am addressing these remarks is a higher level of consciousness than many of us are comfortable with much of the time, because it forces us, like William Burroughs said when he wrote Naked Lunch, to look at what it is on the end of our fork before we eat it. So, it's about assumptions. All right. Any questions at this point? So we're practically done and I'm not on page one yet. It's so typical of me, honestly. any questions?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, no, and keep the camera on me, please. yes?
What then is the value placed on the novels, William Gibson, Stevenson, in helping us to find those new areas?
Well, the question he's really asking is, what is the value of science fiction, especially cyberpunk science fiction, in helping to define the landscape of the topography that I'm describing, correct?
Yes.
Good man. All right, science fiction is the way society dreams. Science fiction is the right brain imagining of a left brain technological society. So let's take a look at science fiction shortly. Jules Verne, From the Earth to the Moon, written when? 1869. 100 years later, we land on the moon. Vision, reality. took 100 years. Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, 1932, right? Something like that. 1990s, 60 years later, we are engaged in massive global social conditioning. We call it management of perception, or entertainment, or media, or spin. But it's a whole talk on how that's really done. It took about 60 years before the realities envisioned there came to reality. Neuromancer, written in the 80s. And yet in 1990s, everyone knows what a consensual hallucination called cyberspace really looks like. So what is it in fact that has happened? The gap between the vision and the reality has gotten shorter and shorter and shorter. Why? Members of nation states were boundaries around appropriate levels of abstraction for the management of the flow of information. And that is contingent directly on the information and communication technologies which a civilization has involved. Of course, it's more complex than that. I'm oversimplifying. Propulsion systems, material science, and many other factors come into this. But in fact, the flow of information has gotten so fast that what has happened to science fiction? Bruce Sterling said that you can't look up any more than maybe, if you're good, 5 years. 5 years. And what has happened to the essence of science fiction? It used to be iRobot. The movie, years later, from Asimov's Foundation. It was nuts and bolts stuff. It was technology. It was the evolution of science in the future. That has shifted radically in our generation to questions of identity and humanity. It goes back to identity. So you have Kim people by Brin, or you have, what's his name, Morgan, Richard Morgan, Altered Carbon. These are questions of clones and persistence, and you go back to Philip K. Dick, who, just like McLuhan, it took a full generation for Philip K. Dick's ideas to become relatively accessible to a population through movies like Blade Runner or Total Recall or other movies that are made based on his far-seeing ideas. A lot of people thought he was nuts. A lot of people, maybe not so many, most don't care, but some people think I'm nuts. And I confess that openly and lovingly. Because I got a track record now. And the things that people said were nuts that I said now can be seen to have been prescient. You know, and the difference is you got to live long enough to find out you're not nuts. You're just seeing things as they emerge at an appropriate level of perception. So science fiction has become about the question of human identity, and it's morphing. Blade Runner raises the question of memory. How do you know yourself? How does memory persist? Well, by photographs. Photographs are, you know, images of memory. All right, so what is, on a global societal scale, the management of perception that I've been describing, but the creation of memories by those who design them, and therefore help to create the big picture which we believe and accept at face value, which you might call, for a metaphor, a digital cage, in which we, like birds, are given enough freedom to flap our wings and therefore sustain the illusion of flying. And when you want to move a bird that's in a large digital cage, you don't have to touch the bird, and the bird doesn't even know it. You just illusion, misdirection, ridicule. That came from a master of cover and deception. These are our three greatest things. You move the cage, and the bird flapping its wings in the cage and not even knowing its parameters have shifted, moves over here. So you manage the memories of a population. I ask people about Vietnam, or things that I thought were in recent memory. You know, people, even those who were in the society at the time, don't remember Vietnam. They remember what they have been constructed as memories to remember about the time. Just like JFK, you know, people, the gunman on the knoll and the grassy knoll and all those things. Do you know that there were many eyewitnesses when you go back and look at the transcripts of what they said when they were interviewed for hours at the time and then subsequently interviewed? Many of the details, by conflation from the public discussion, came into their real memories. They didn't think they were lying. They didn't know they were lying. They didn't know they had created a construction of the event scene called the Kennedy assassination on the basis of how it was managed and articulated by a society for many purposes other than the truth of which were a goal. So memory and the persistence of self are how we know who we are. And when the identity that was collectively engendered for us has disappeared, we're left with asking who are we? And science fiction, Neuromancer, a lot of the science fiction I look at is a way of trying to anticipate what it is that is coming. I'll get to your question in just one second, because I don't really want to forget this. I want to just throw this out, given the time. I think I have it reasonably ready at hand, because one of the questions becomes, how do you know what's on the edges? And I was just, again, the guy from InQtel, everything I mentioned, well, military research, of course, is where you go, because 20 years later, it's going to be society. Another is the sex and gambling industry. Why? Because our vices are what? By definition, call them vices if you want in a puritanical Protestant society, or things we love deeply and crave. Why do they make money? Because we love them. Why do people look at pictures of things that excite them? Because they are pictures of things that excite them. That's why they're willing to pay money in order to look at them. Therefore, where's the money going to flow? It's going to flow into the R&D of the sex and gambling industries first and foremost, whenever information and communication technologies are transforming themselves. You know, look at how the VCR got into the home. Some of you graybacks like Lou remember the 60s when we first had Deep Throat and Beyond the Green Door? Still classics, right? Showing up in the neighborhood theater, the Ramette Theater, I remember, suddenly showed Behind the Green Door in the 60s. And what happened to middle-class America, righteous as it was? They wanted to take them home and watch them again and again. And therefore, the platform for VCRs suddenly became viable. Hollywood opposed it radically, the way they oppose everything that looks like a threat, until they realized, wait a minute, people, like children, want to hear the same bedtime story again and again and again. We can not only get them into the theaters to watch it, we can then sell them the movie afterward, and you know the industry that's developed. So now we're all for DVDs and VCRs. So sex and gambling are a good place to go to see what the R&D is building. But the other one that I wanted to mention, because it relates to sci-fi, is children. What are children playing with? What games has society intuitively understood it must use to socialize children to have the kinds of thinking and behaviors that it wants them to have in 10 or 15 years when they grow into adulthood? So look at games. It's why I originally came to DEF CON. I perceived what was happening to me. I perceived that the world was transforming, and unless I came hat in hand with humility and due respect to my mentors who were 15 years old and who would kindly and gently teach me about the world they were creating and co-creating by building the net in the good old days when hacking was still a myth, before it became a metaphor, before it became just chips and switches, back when we believed the myth, John Perry Barlow talking about cyberspace floating above meat space. And when you believe the myth, you don't know it's a myth. When you start talking about it's a metaphor, you're moving away from the myth. People who believe in Zeus as a god don't know they're believing in a myth. But after a while, when they talk about Zeus as a metaphor for X, Y, and Z, they started to deconstruct it, and then you start to talk about human society and how people think about gods and images and metaphors. By the time you get to an objective scientific description, the myth and the metaphor have lost their potency. So I look at what kids are playing with, and this was on the window of a museum in Milwaukee, where I lived not long ago. A museum shop, and this is what they were selling. Just listen and think about how each one of these is a pointer toward what is emergent, not in the future, but now, or else it couldn't have been thought by a museum staff in Milwaukee. Off-world gear, weapons for the mind, cyber pets, idea generators, cosmic debris, alien life forms, space armor, space junk, thought reactors. You don't even have to know what kind of gibberish that is to get an image of the kind of world we want our children to begin playing with so that their creativity and imagination can take us off-world. Now, what is off-world going to be? It's going to be the new center. I talked about the thing moving from the edge to the center. I gave an example. 200 years ago, you're in England, you say to somebody in the city of London, on the steps of the banks of London, where's the center of the world? They'd say, right here, 1780, right here in London, the center of the world. And they'd say, and what are the things like America? It's America, colonies. The word designated our reality was colonies. That is, that which is on the edge compared to the center. But if someone had eyes to see, they would have seen that already the edge was becoming the new center. In 200 years, we would emerge in the American century. And already, by the time it becomes the center, the American century is over. Even if we still live within the structures we have built for empire, we are in, after all, over 150 countries with an armed presence. I mean, we are more than Rome dreamed it could be. So by the time it gets from the edge to the center, it's over. Well, what is the center today? Well, people point to that picture of Earth taken from space the first time, and it was a transforming moment for humankind. We saw that globe, white, blue, that gorgeous orb hanging in black space from outside itself for the first time. We saw ourselves whole, and the echo movement was jumped into a new level of activity because we saw that we lived on a fragile, transparent planet. We'd better take care of it. people are referring to something that's 20, 30 years old. If you think that the Earth as a whole thing is the new center, you're already 20, 30 years. The new center is out there, but we don't have names for it yet. We call it space. But in my lifetime, we've colonized with our telerobotic extensions, Spirit and Opportunity on Mars, and the probe going around Saturn, the probe that's going to land on Titan. And we have virtually made our neighborhood the solar system, and the people I talk to doing advanced propulsion systems, they don't guess, they know we're going transgalactic. And the Earth is the center the way England was the center. And the Earth is no longer the center. If you have eyes to see, look at what kids are playing with. Off-world gear, alien life forms, space armor, space junk, trying to get your mind around this reality that forces you to examine your assumptions is very, very difficult. So when I'm talking to somebody from DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and apropos of alien life forms, he suddenly changes his demeanor and he gets angry and he hits the table and he says, God damn it, yes, we know they're here. We know they're here and they've done surveillance and there's not a damn thing we can do about it. What do you do with that? You just go put cream in your Starbucks and come back and suddenly talk about, you know, the Cubs or whatever. You go back to consensus reality because the edge is too difficult to grasp when it first emerges, and original and creative thinkers are those, Nietzsche said, who see it first and give it a name before others see it, and therefore people believe that they invented it practically, but all they did is see it. Space tourism is now more and more in the forefront. When I talked to Buzz Aldrin about it 10 years ago, it was not. He wanted to build orbiting hotels so people could be up there expanding the interface of those who have gone off Earth so he could fuel inject the economy for off-world travel as a touristic environment. It's coming. You know it's coming. I want to go. You want to go. Well, what kind of political and structural changes is that going to mean? Well, it means that when you ask, well, where is the USA going to be? When I was at Los Alamos talking, one of the other presenters was ex-KGB head of counterintelligence. Ex-KGB. I said, ex-KGB is not an identity. To have been something and yet to persist without a name is not an identity. And it is our destiny for all of us always to be moving into that place without a name where we must reinvent our identity based on the structures that our technology has defined as the appropriate levels of economic, social, and political intercourse. And it is no longer nation states, and it is no longer even transglobals, because by the time I can describe them, like at that conference for stock managers who are trying to get how they can define countries and their values, and companies and their values that had no locus or nexus to specific countries, it gets very, very murky. All right. Question. Okay, over here. Okay.
You made a reference to the bird in the cage, bird in the media cage, those analogies. On one hand, referencing that our perceptions and our reality were being constructed for us, but on the other hand, you referenced the absolute creative, possibilities that are endless in our future, and I'm having a hard time
getting those together?
Yeah.
Yes, me too. Because it means coming to terms. It's Chinatown. You know the movie Chinatown? I used to refer to movies like Lawrence of Arabia and Chinatown and expect people to know those classics, and now I find it's not true. Even when I was in Eilat, Israel, and said, Aqaba is over there. It's only a matter of going. Nobody laughed. Aqaba was a half a mile, a cab ride away. But nobody knew I was quoting Sharif Ali and Lawrence of Arabia, so I can't do that anymore. But in Chinatown, you know, at the end, it's Chinatown, boss. It's Chinatown. Well, I mean, the kind of reality I'm talking about requires a capacity to live comfortably enough with ambiguity and complexity so that you never quite manage it except for now. It's why scenario planning emerged in 1973, OPEC oil crisis, as a new way of constructing the future as a spectrum of possibilities rather than straight line management by objective. Our whole way of thinking about the future changed, and it changed as an image of the technologies of information we were using that had symbiotically transformed us into new human identities. And once that's happened, you don't remember who you were in the same way. People say, oh, but humans have always been this way. No, as template maybe, as hardware perhaps, but not as software, not as cultures. How we are is different. So, the task, and if you buy this book, I'll give away two of these for free to anyone who has persisted through this whole talk and raises their hand high enough. there's an essay in here on James Jesus Angleton. It's called Why We Are All Getting a Little Crazy. It's about as well as I can say it, about how the task of counterintelligence has become the task of any human being who wants to know what's going on. And every time we expose a mole, every time Angleton exposed a mole, he became convinced he was allowed to discover that mole by the Soviets to hide a higher-placed mole. And the result was he rampaged through CIA looking for that mole, destroying careers, leading to being wreckage, until finally, as I said, he could go into that good night and go off to some lake and trail his fingers in the cold water. And why do we trail our fingers in the cold water? Because cold is a fact we can feel in a world that has gone dark and suddenly very liquid. We're talking about nested levels, fractal-like, nested levels of ambiguity and complexity that task us collectively to try to determine the truth in an era in which truth has become a black market commodity. We know there are numerous well-woven lies spread like a tapestry through our minds and connecting us in a narrative. But we also seem to recognize the fact of the cold water on our fingers when we feel it. And we exchange this truth in the darkness, the way people in the Soviet Union of old would talk in whispers on darkened stairways. And then you build a black market in truth. And what you're really doing is building a construction of reality that makes more sense to the cognoscenti, i.e. you, who are willing to persist in the quest to understand what's going on. But you do it in Chinatown. You never know what's going on. And the closer I get to the truth, I mean, I am closer to some truths than I've ever been in my life. And I am aghast. And I'm telling you the truth, I don't know how to talk about it quite yet. The things I think I have found out and put together to illuminate what I'm trying to describe. It's a very difficult task. But the fact that you can never win doesn't mean you shouldn't play. Did you see Deconstructing Harry by Woody Allen? At the end, he's talking to Billy Crystal playing the devil, and he's whining about how things had gone for him, and Billy Crystal says, hey, sometimes you're up, sometimes you're down. In the end, the house always wins. It doesn't mean you didn't have fun. That's the position we're in. You can't beat the cosmos, but you can engage in using your creativity and imagination in all the ways that you believe are important, according to the level of your vision and perception, knowing it is partial for now. And that's all we can exchange with each other, is good enough visions for now. When we come here, and we don't really have time to go there to see what it looks like, but I'd hope we would begin to explore what are the assumptions you believe are true that are probably already well on their way toward the center. What is it that everybody in the security space believes that therefore has become not true in relationship to the genuine threat? And what is the genuine threat? And as soon as you see that the genuine threat is so much worse than you thought, what is the default position of the human mind? To flip up into a level of a threat defined as something it can manage. And therefore we define security as managing the threats we can conceptualize and respond to. But like box cutters and jets, those aren't the threats that are going to be coming at us. And that's where the imagination and the creativity holds forth. Ultimately, it's a battle for orderliness in a transglobal society that we believe is good enough to preserve and therefore worthy of our best efforts. Terror is simply chaos threatening orderliness. Orderliness at the extreme is fascism. We want it more balanced than that. But we want to be able to have a conference, eat a good lunch, talk to each other, you know? We want life. And that requires structure. And therefore we even wind up conceding collusion with the makers of the cage, because they are good to us and feed us every morning at 9 o'clock. Question?
I found this notion of examining what children find interesting in terms of play. That really struck a chord with me. Without leaving the planet Earth, I see my own 11 and 12 year old with this interest and fascination with the Sims of Little Rex.
Right.
And I hear it in everyday conversation with my friends, too. That would be being in front of a computer screen. They're talking a lot like any God would talk if God existed. You know, I'm creating and making people do things or it's a form of creation. And then it's so really existing for it.
Well, it's time for somebody else to start, so I'll just say that I got a book signing out there at 11, so I'll go out there and keep talking. But why do you say I'm only signing books from
11 or 11:15, I don't know. I'll get up at 3 in the morning and meet you in the alley behind the lab and sign your book. I mean, I'll take a taxi there and then take you home in the taxi and give you a power bar, you know, as you go up. I mean, listen. I was a priest for 16 years. You're asking a question that is difficult for me to ask simply. Let me just reduce it to the lowest common denominator, which is, in the best theological traditions, human beings as creative and imaginative beings are images of that God they have imagined and with whom they therefore co-create the universe. It is what we get to do. But you don't want to believe the simulated reality in our heads that we have created. You always want to step back and feel the fuzziness, the strangeness that comes with true anomaly penetrating, you know, your vision. And Robert Moore said to me, he said, I read some of the things in your book. He said, they're bubbles. And you have to go into the bubble, and then you're in the bubble, and it all makes sense. You come out of the bubble, and he said, you know, I think there's a madman in there somewhere. Well, I'll take that from him. You know, so theology is very close to madness. Because if it's any good, it entails experiences that take you through zones of annihilation that utterly transform and powerfully destroy who you think you were on the road to something else. And that's where we go to societies, too. And that's why Alfred North Whitehead said, those processes that are genuinely revolutionary all but wreck the societies in which they occur. When we're comfortable and having coffee, that's fun, seminar room stuff, wreck societies. But when things are aflame and Godzilla's rampaging through the streets of San Francisco, it's not so much fun if you're in San Francisco, right? So, there's more to say, but thank you very, very much. Who would like a book? These are, thanks. Okay, no more men. One to a man, one to a woman. I know it's unfair. You don't count. That's not fair. Okay, you can have it. I won't throw it because it'll hit the guy in the head. Yeah, right. Okay.